Are you expecting to find a lost romance at the Hotel Jerome?
Yeah, how about any romance? Hopefully it's not the last romance.
Oh, I know that feeling too, but we won't go there, right?
No, we won't.
Well, you are gathered here, Mike, along with Wendy Perkins. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Wendy.
Glad to have
hey,
you
Mike.
Here. And also Chip Wynn Wells is here.
Hello, great, both
hi,
of you.
And Mike Monroney, the director of The Lost Romance, which has its opening this weekend at Thunder River Theater. Thanks for joining me, y'all.
You bet. Thank you for having us. And
yep.
It's a very exciting time for us this week.
Mm-hmm. Mike, definitely.
Mike,
and Luke, you're saying The Last Romance, right?
I did say that, didn't I?
It sounded like The Lost.
Oh, okay. The Last.
It's not Lost. It's Last.
That's a crucial distinction, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think it, well, we won't go there.
We won't go there.
Because we don't want to spoil it, do we?
No. Nope.
Mike, maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about the story. What is the last
See?
The last romance about? Tell me.
Well, it's a terrific little play by Joe DiPietro that tells the story of three and, dare I call them, senior citizens.
You dare.
There's a...
Go for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, is that okay? I mean, I can use that, right?
Sure.
Wendy?
Well, we are.
Yeah.
I'm
and,
proud of it.
They live across the river from Manhattan in New Jersey. And the gentleman who is sort of the focal point of the play, Ralph Bellini, is out for a walk one day, and in just a pure turn of chance, goes a different route and ends up in a little dog park and sees a woman with a little chihuahua, and something clicks for him. And he sort of comes the next day hoping to engineer a chance to meet her, and does. Meanwhile, back at home, his sister, who's been taking care of him for the last 12 years since his wife died, is wondering where he's gone, and, you know, suspects he's missing, and finds out from a friend that he's walked into this park. So the three of their lives intersect for the first time, and relationships between the three become, you know, developed and intersect and sort of intertwine, and that's the basis of the story of the show.
And that man is Ralph.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And that Ralph in this play is played by Willie Moseley, is that correct?
Also correct.
True.
Willie, mm-hmm. We love you, Willie. I was just telling the ladies that I knew Willie back in the day, way back when we first hit Aspen, and I was hoping he would be here. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
And back way back in the day, Willie and I worked together at the Crystal Palace. So I've known Willie since the very early 80s, and Mike as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So you guys sort of know each other's tendencies on the stage.
Yes.
Huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I think this is the fourth play that I've directed that Willie was in.
Oh.
And I've been in plays with Wendy, but it's my first experience working with Chip.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Huh.
I've worked with both Willie and Wendy before, but not with Mike.
How about that? Huh. So, Wendy, eventually you fall in love with Ralph. Is that right?
Eventually, I do.
But it takes a while.
It's hard to believe as that is, yes.
Yes. It's not hard to believe. Ralph is adorable.
No,
he's
he is adorable.
Adorable. It's the theme of the play is really that, you know, people do, they fall in love and something gets in the way. Basically. And the older you get and the more baggage you have, the more likely something is going to get in the way.
And also that how far are people willing to go to not be alone? And how important
right.
is that fear of being alone?
So do the characters discover that they can drop all that baggage, Wendy?
Well, I don't want to be a spoiler here. So
okay.
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
Nor I.
Yes and no.
Now, Chip, you mm-hmm. play Rose, who is Ralph's sister.
Correct.
Are you one of the impediments to this romance?
I don't think so.
No?
No. not at all.
It would appear so at the beginning of the play.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So there's an arc there.
There mm-hmm. is an arc there. And there mm-hmm. are discoveries in the second act somewhere towards the end of the play.
You mean there's skeletons in the closet?
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. And I also think that there's a term out there called an interrupting angel. And I think that in some ways, something that appears at first to be an impediment is actually an interrupting angel that causes you to change your course of action. And I think all of us, Ralph and Carol and Rose, all have their chance to be an interrupting angel.
Huh. Good point.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Huh. I like that.
Does everybody else accept that, though?
In time, I in think time. So.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, with any relationship there, you know, I have never been in any relationship that has just been off at the start smooth and perfect. I think there are bumps and lumps and, you know, discoveries about each other and, you know, what do we have at stake in creating this relationship? And, you know, where are the impediments? How do we get past them? And how important is it to get past them? You know, both in my relationship with Ralph and my relationship with Rose.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, consequences in this play for every possible outcome. And obviously we're not going to tell you what the actual outcome of the play is, but you know, if one relationship is successful, it's possible that it's at the detriment of another. It's possible that, you know, the success of love in one place might be, you know, the ruin of love in another. So it's in some ways it's sort of an unlikely and out of the norm triangle. You know, normally a love triangle is between one person who's in love with two others purely in a romantic way, and this is a triangle between a brother and a sister and another woman who enters their lives, and it's different, but every bit is valid in terms of looking at the way, you know, human emotions play out.
Well, go ahead, Wendy.
I play Carol, who's the love interest of Ralph, and I work with older people. I work with the elderly, and what I find in all three of these characters is kind of more of a desperation because we're running out of time. So there's a desperation in kind of keeping the status quo for Rose, certainly, and a desperation in, is there anything else in this life, or do I have to resolve myself to accepting the status quo for both Ralph and Carol?
So you're not talking a desperation of mortality, but a desperation.
Well, there's a desperation of mortality that's always hanging over.
Okay. Huh.
You know, when people get in the, you know, the people in this play are in their late 70s, beginning 80.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
So there's that, but it's also the idea that you're running out of time to create or maintain a human connection.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Because
totally
your peer group is slowly dying away.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's interesting because, you know, we're used to teenagers falling in love at the drop of a hat and that those relationships don't always necessarily last. And I think we always tend as, you know, parents and friends and advisors, you know, for people to take your time, wait and see how this works out. Don't go jumping into anything. But it's interesting that the arc takes us from the immediacy of that teenage love into our, you know, the winter of our lives, and yeah, we sort of need to make things happen really, really fast if there's going to be a chance of any success and any, you know, fruition of those relationships.
Plus, I don't think that there's any age to responding to the hormones that are reactivated, no matter how old you are.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
If you find something that feels good, it feels good, and you would like for it to keep
develop.
On. Yeah, and continue.
One of my favorite lines in the play is when Ralph describes how being touched by Rose makes him feel.
No,
I mean,
Carol.
By Carol. By Carol, yeah.
This play is not about incest.
No.
Absolutely not.
No.
Well, I would think there's a danger in overly sentimentalizing mature love, let's call it. You know, that golden gauzy on golden pond kind of thing.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that as you were working this?
Well, I actually, at Thunder River, I played Ethel in, on Golden Pond. And it in this play, there is lots of humor. There's humor in the characters. There's humor in the writing. It's really a well-written, lovely play, as there was in Golden Pond. Mm-hmm. There is sentimentality. I think the audience will go away with a real feeling of being touched and, you know, crying and laughing and, you know.
I guess what I was referring to was that there might be a danger of, I don't know what, being a little condescending, like, oh, look at the old folks. They're they're falling in love.
No.
No?
Not yeah.
If you come away with that, we haven't done our job.
Okay.
Huh. Right. I think we approach these people, you know, trying to make them as real as possible. And when you do that and you make, and it, first off, it's extremely well written. And I feel like the playwright really understands these people and the, you know, the age group that he's portraying. But if you come at it from a position of honesty and trusting the script and creating those relationships, then it's real. It's not, I think it's not painted with a brush that's, as you would have put it, too gauzy or too sentimental.
Hmm. Well, I guess like anything else, humor is a saving grace as far as that goes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh. It certainly has to be.
Yeah. I understand opera plays a part in this. Tell me.
Well, there's a fourth character in the play. We've talked about three, the brother and sister and the new love interest, Carol, but there's a fourth character who doesn't actually really exist. He only appears in Ralph's memory, but it's a version of his younger self. And in his youth, he actually auditioned for the Metropolitan Opera. And he's of Italian heritage. He loves Italian opera. And so this fourth character, who we call Raphael, comes into play and comments on the action in Italian and sings some classic Italian opera as the show goes along.
And there is actually a character and a man named Chris Gasquetta, who is
right.
an opera singer.
Thank you.
Who he's
Thank
a real person
yeah.
mm-hmm. who does come and sing. He's not
yeah,
just in Ralph's imagination.
Real. Yeah, the actor's real, yeah. but the character is. We get to see him, but the other people in the play don't.
So mm-hmm. you say that that person provides a little commentary, kind of like a Greek chorus.
Certainly a good analogy, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Definitely.
One of the lines I came across, which I didn't read the script, but I read, you know, several commentaries on the play, something about in opera life is big.
Mm-hmm.
Everything
yeah.
is big. You walk through the door and you sing an aria and it's big.
Yeah. And Carol responds to that by saying, life should be like that.
Huh. Huh. Do you think only older people think that?
Probably
not.
No.
No. No, of course not.
No. Yeah. But I think people
that don't think that way never get to be old. They just, just kind of stay
wither
the same
away.
And they wither.
Yeah.
Well,
I really feel that way.
And I do think as people get older, generally their vision becomes more contained
mm-hmm.
and their lives are not as full mm-hmm. because they can't do as much and they don't do as much and they're not working and they're not raising a family and, you know, often they're away from their children as Carol is. So, yeah, I mean, their lives really take a turn at that late 70, 80-year-old stage.
So right. It's notable that in that stage of life, both characters believe that life can be big and you can sing an aria. Still.
Well, it's amazing what love can do.
Mm-hmm.
It makes everything, you feel young and you feel big and you feel, you
powerful.
Know, powerful. Uh-huh. You don't feel like you're an 80-year-old decrepit person, you know? your youth returns.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I find that in the character of Carol.
And you must see it in your work. mm-hmm. as well.
Huh. Would a younger person profit from seeing this show?
Oh, yes.
Certainly they'll be entertained. I have no doubt of that.
Yep.
Yeah, no question.
Yep. And we can't leave today without saying something about Peaches.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. Another character. Go ahead. No, I'll let you. Since you get to interact with the dog, I'll let you explain it. But there are many dogs who are part of the play, but one in particular.
Because most of the play takes place in the dog park, the dog run, and Carol's initial love interest is a little Chihuahua named Peaches, who comes from the care center in Carbondale, She's a rescue dog, and Carol talks to Peaches, but the audience doesn't get to see Peaches right away.
Oh.
And I'm not going to give that spoiler.
Good.
But okay. Even though I just did.
So we
did get an adorable little dog that does appear in the second act.
Well, what happens if the dog barks in the wrong place?
I don't know that there is a wrong place, quite frankly.
Nope. We're actors. We can deal with anything.
So there's a little bit of improv attitude there.
Certainly.
There has to be in every theatrical endeavor. There has to be improv.
Exactly.
Because you never know what's going to come out of somebody else's mouth.
That's right. That's right.
You mean the incorrect line at the wrong time or something?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, could be.
Oh, okay. Well, Chip, we haven't heard a lot from you. Tell me about your character, Rose. You're the sister of Ralph, and you're a little bit of a metal, aren't you?
I think that Rose is a human being trying to meet her basic human needs. And she's limited in what she has available to her because her whole role in life has been dependent upon the way other people define her. And so I think she does an amazing job with what little she has. And I like Rose. I really do like her.
Because, I like her too.
Because she's got spunk and she has compassion. And she, even though she fights it, she's not too old to learn. And I like that about her, and I respect that.
Huh. Well, like I said, I didn't read the script, but just what little I read, she didn't come across as a particularly sympathetic character. So I guess something happens in the script that I'm not aware of.
Well, yeah. An actor got a hold of it. Uh-huh.
And the thing with all of these characters, and, you know, due not only to the talent of the playwright, but the talent of the actors themselves, is they all undergo some metamorphosis over the course of the play. I think, you know, any good work, you see people change and see them learn, and there's no question that that happens in this play.
Let's talk a little bit about the sets.
The set is, as we said, it all takes place in the dog park. So we've got sidewalks, we've got a bench, we've got a tree. You can see the New York City skyline in the distance. And then right in the middle of the park, at least in the physical reality, we actually see the apartment where Rose and Ralph live. Or the house. So there's a very sort of metamorphosis in the set itself from one location to the other. They almost exist within each other and sort of represent, you know, Ralph being pulled away from the home that he shares by what happens in the park, and you know, Rose's bastion is where she lives. So I think it's a very interesting set. Everything just sort of flows. There's a spot up actually in the audience where our opera singer performs most of his work, you know, representing once again that special place in Ralph's memory. And so everything sort of just flows together and exists side by side. We actually have the younger Ralph assisting with some of the set changes. So even though the other characters don't actually see him, they are affected by what he does.
And then also the upstage railing, I think, is so cool because it goes from really a slats in a fence, and then it starts just changing, and it becomes wainscoting in an apartment. It's very cool. I love that.
Sean did an amazing, amazing job.
Sean?
Yeah.
Sean.
He's Jeffries.
Sean Jeffries.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And he is the set director and lighting and sound at Thunder River.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's remarkable.
He's the technical director, yes.
And the costumes? I understand that Ralph is sort of a working man. He was through his life, whereas Carol maybe was a little bit upper class.
Yes, she was.
Is that right?
Yep, she was. She was an executive secretary, which you know, in that age was quite a feat to be an executive. You know, it was quite. Uh-huh. She wasn't a teacher or a nurse. Uh-huh. She was an executive secretary. So she's very well put together, which was not easy for me to put those costumes together because I live in Aspen, you know.
We were talking about that before the interview. They dressed differently back east.
Yeah. Yeah, they did.
And Rose clearly is wearing a dress that her mother wore.
Okay.
And because why not? It's still good. And it served her mother. It's going to serve her in much the same way.
Huh. I want to say one more thing about the set and, you know, where we're playing, where the play takes place. It creates, you know, the whole atmosphere creates a real intimacy, knowing the characters. The audience is really, you know, not part of the set, so don't be afraid out there. You're not going to be part of the play, but we are playing, you know, right up to 4 feet of the audience on three different sides, so it's a three-quarters side.
Huh.
Yeah.
You know, Mike, what's the decision-making process on things like that? I guess that's your purview.
The decision-making process in terms of choosing the play or once the play?
No, the staging, like what Wendy was just describing.
With a small cast like this, it's really easy to collaborate as a group and sort of determine, you know, sort of let the blocking happen out of the lines. And then once you have a basic framework, you know, then I can sort of begin to, you know, inject my, you know, theatrical personality on, you know, sort of tweaking, you know, maybe this person should stand here and maybe it helps, you know, the humor if a certain person is there and reacts to a line in a certain way. Because we always think that a line is funny, but honestly, in theater and even in movies and television, it's how the characters around that person react to that line that often create the humor. So this, the way the audience and the stage are set up in the show, creates some interesting blocking challenges because of sight lines and the fact that the audience stretches around three sides of the stage and the certain angles, you almost have to block it as if the play is in the round so that every side of the audience gets something to watch at all times. So that's fun. That's actually really fun to sort of, you know, I try and sit in a different place in the audience every night when I'm directing so I get an idea of what different parts of the audience are experiencing.
It's interesting that you talk about essentially what you're saying when you're talking about how the impact of the humor comes from the way characters react to each other.
Exactly.
That implies to me a radical trust in your actors.
No question. Yeah.
Well,
and
I
in
hope
each other.
So.
They, mm-hmm. they have to trust each other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. They have to really listen and really trust each other. And it's interesting. You know, there's you want everything to be natural, but there is a technical side to acting on the stage, and you know, you have to allow that the audience is part of that collaboration as well. You have to sort of learn how the audience laughs and not say a line while they're laughing so they lose something. And you actually sort of, in the early part of a play, train the audience how to react to what you're presenting.
And all of us actors in this play have been around on the stage for a long, long time. So we're used to, you know, responding to the audience and being in the present moment. What the beauty of theater is, it's present moment. And if you're somewhere else, you're going to screw up, and you're going to screw up your fellow actors. So really, to stay right there with each other is so important, and that's really part of the, you know, the joy of doing theater.
Because when you're rehearsing, it's kind of linear, and then when the audience shows up, suddenly you're in this amazingly firm base of support because you're in a triangular arrangement, and boy, oh boy, does that enrich things. It really fleshes it out. It does.
Interesting. Well, The Last Romance opening this weekend. Opening night is Friday, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's correct.
And then it runs two more weekends after that.
Yep. Which
correct.
Is all,
it's all... with the, our final performance, at least in Carbondale, being actually on Christmas Eve, a matinee. So if people have family visiting from out of town and are looking for something to do over the holidays, it's sort of a nice way to kick off the holidays with your family.
And then the show moves to Snowmass Chapel in January for two weekends.
Oh, that's kind of a different thing, isn't it?
At the end of January.
Right.
Huh. Yep.
Is that an effort to, what, broaden your base a little bit? Is that?
It's a collaboration that works both for us and for the Snowmass Chapel. They've often produced theatrical events in the chapel there. Their schedule didn't allow for them to take that on this year. So it was, I don't remember which way it went, if they asked us or if we asked them, but we're always looking, you know, to be accessible. Often people in Aspen or Snowmass, believe it or not, aren't willing to drive past the Intercept lot to go to Carbondale to see something. Or to Glenwood to see something. Mm-hmm. So it's the first time we've tried it. I think it's a good chance for us to see what sharing this show with a different part of the valley can offer to everybody.
And in a very different space.
Yep.
Very different.
Mm-hmm. Chip and I actually were in Calendar Girls a year and a half ago together at the Snowmass Chapel. So we are familiar with the stage and its differences.
Limitations.
I was going to say that, but I thought it'd be nice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you deal with what you have, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mike Monroney, I want to thank you for joining us by telephone, the director of The Last Romance. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Luke. I really appreciate it. Thanks, ladies, for being here as well.
Yep. Thank you, Mikey.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Wendy Perkins, and thank you, Chip Wynn Wells.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, Luke.